After the early Anglo-Saxon versions, which were very limited, attempts to place very small portions of the Bible into the native tongue, about 600 years go by. Amid the disturbance resulting from the Danish invasion of England, there was little time for thinking of translations and manuscripts. And before the land had fully regained its quiet, the fatal Battle of Hastings had been fought, and England lay helpless at the feet of the Normans. French speakers. The higher Saxon clergy were replaced by the priests of Normandy, who had little sympathy over the people of England, the people over whom they were placed, and the Saxon manuscripts, few as they were contemptuously flung aside as relics of a rude barbarism. The contempt shown to the language of the defeated race, the English, quite destroyed the impulse to English translation, and the Norman clergy, dominating England as the conquerors, had no sympathy with the desire for spreading the knowledge of the scriptures among the people, so that for centuries those scriptures remained in England a fountain sealed. Yet this time must not be considered altogether lost, for during those centuries England was becoming fitted for an English Bible. Now there are people who think that from the day that Brutus arrived and formed new law, new Troy, later called London, the English language just fell like acorns right off the oak trees and was always spoken the way we now speak it. Oh, a few people have deviated, like the Southerners and Brooklyn. The good old ordinary Midwestern and Western American English has always been, from the time of Brutus. Frankly, I can understand an Englishman now. And it is to our Bible translations, I believe, more than to Chaucer and other such literature giants, particularly Tyndale, that we owe the shape of our current English tongue. And it was at this time the future language of the nation, English, was being formed. The Saxon and the Norman French, who conquered the Saxons, were struggling side by side. Gradually, the old Saxon grew unintelligible to the people. And gradually the French became a foreign tongue, and with the fusion of the two races, a language grew up which was the language of United England. In tracing the history of the change from Anglo-Saxon to modern English, see, there are people who are crying about it. Well, you believe the Bible's in that word of God? Now, in the previous few weeks, as we've studied the more ancient manuscripts that provide the foundation for the English Bible, some of you have been surprised to find that the three great uncial manuscripts, copies from the original Greek in capital letters, the Vatican, the Sinaiticus, and the Alexandrinus, were none of them available to the King James translators. We've been intrigued to find that two of those three great, most ancient manuscripts, two of the three do not include the last few verses of the closing chapter of Mark. One of those two leaves space. The other doesn't leave any space. We've been interested to find out that the Sinaitic by Tischendorf, his finder, had four separate scribes who were not copying by sight, but rather copying like a secretary takes dictation while someone read. How many of you always thought when manuscripts were copied that some poor soul was sitting there looking at this copy and then copying another one? Well, that happened on occasions, which caused them to sometimes misalign if two lines happened to end with the same word, and tired, they'd leave a line out. But the Sinaiticus and the Alexandrinus give evidence of more probably having been copied by several scribes who were listening to someone read. Tischendorf thought four scribes. Subsequent scholars found three, and that these scribes have a signature, which is their little drawing they put at the end of each book. Just as individual to the scribes as a fingerprint. And that of the three, finally concluded to be the three who copied the Sinaitic manuscript found in St. Catherine's at the foot of Mount Sinai, subsequently in St. Petersburg and sold by Stalin to the British, and in the British Museum, where a great deal of scholarship could be expended on it, that of those three scribes, one was a good speller, one was an average speller, and one was a terrible speller. Which, if they were just copying by sight, would not be so obvious. But when taking dictation and writing the words, the bad spellers, you can tell when he's at work by his spelling as well as his signature equivalent of a cartouche at the end. We know the Alexandrine didn't show up until 17 years after. It didn't arrive in Britain until 17 years after, 16 to 17 years, after the first edition of the King James came out. Intended to be a gift to James, but instead to Charles, his successor. And they did include the Epistle of Clement. And we found that a couple of manuscripts read, which of you having an ox or an ass in a ditch will not pull it out on the Sabbath? Another one reads, which of you having an ox or a son in a ditch will not pull it out on the Sabbath? And remember, I lamented a little bit because I'm less, you know, over my life, I found I've been less prone to get a ox or a son in a ditch. My ass is in a ditch all the time. Yeah. I like the license to get your ass out of trouble. That seemed to me to give a lot more latitude on the Sabbath. Oprah Winfrey used to like that too. Not as important to her anymore. Then we found one copy. That'll hit you after a while. Then we had one copyist who just I guess, was too frustrated to make the choice. So his version read, "Which of you, having an ox or a son or an ass?" That resolves the difficulty. And refusing to park our brain is the price of being a Christian. And recognizing the tremendous burst of manuscript discoveries, over 5,000 since the King James, why be surprised when the Alexandrinus is not showing up in Britain until 16 years after the King James, about 1627, and the Sinaiticus isn't discovered by Tischendorf near Mount Sinai until the 1840s? But why be shocked that the same source as the Alexandrian, Constantinople, provides a manuscript of the Book of Acts stuck in between the leaves of Cennini's copy of his travels in Turkey and Asia that includes the 29th chapter of Acts showing Paul visiting Spain and Britain? Vested interests just choose what they want to choose. Like the vested interest in science that decided that Cheops or Khufu built the pyramid on the plateau of Giza, the Great Pyramid, once having swallowed Colonel Weiss's forgery and not wanting to get egg on their face for having swallowed it prematurely because it supported the vested interest position. When Esteli is found some 20 years later, written by Khufu, saying that the pyramid was standing and he built a temple to Isis alongside of it when he began his reign. Rather than change the vested position, you just unilaterally declare the Stelia forgery, when its credentials are far beyond Weiss's forgery. And on top of all this, in regard to the translations, you have the problem of the language itself taking shape. So, the King James being read by Moses on Mount Sinai is enough to cause him to cast it down for more reasons than one and bust it in pieces. English hadn't taken shape. In tracing the history of the change from Anglo-Saxon to modern English, it's impossible to assign any precise dates by which we can mark the origin of this change or the principal epochs of its progress or its completion. This necessarily results from the very gradual nature of the change itself. So gradual was the change that to adopt the language of Hallam, quote, "When we compare the earliest English of the 13th century with the Anglo-Saxon of the 12th, it seems hard to pronounce why it should pass for a separate language, rather than a modification or simplification of the former. Still, for the sake of convenience, we may fix on certain dates somewhere about when the change commenced or was effected. About 1150 A.D., or a little less than a century after the conquest of the Normans, may be dated the decline of pure Saxon. About 1250, or a century later, the commencement of English. During the intervening century, the language has been called by many of our writers semi-Saxon. It was toward the end of the 4th century that English, or 14th century, about the time Columbus arrived here. I would guess, we talk about our English forebears, I would guess that most of us assume that when Columbus came over here and America was discovered, that English was spoken far and wide for centuries among our forebears in England, when in fact that was, and then only about the time, the end of the 14th century, or about 100 years earlier. Columbus came here at the end of the 15th century. About, you know, we would hardly think that language in America had changed since the gold rush here in California. That's 100 and almost 50 years. Well, English in England was only 100 years old when Columbus discovered America. You want me to continue? Go on the telephone.
Listening to Dr. Gene Scott on the University Network. To call in on this program, call 1-800-338-3030 in the United States. That's 1-800-338-3030. Outside the United States, call Collect, 818-240-8151. That's 818-240-8151. Call Collect. Dr. Scott is now on the Internet. You can get him at www.drgenescott.org. Again, Dr. Scott's website is www.drgenescott.org.
The end of the 14th century, 100 years before America was discovered, the second, third, or fourth time by Columbus, that English began to be the language of literature. Sir John Mandeville's Travels, one of the earliest English books, appeared in 1356, and Chaucer wrote toward the close of the century. Therefore, Wycliffe's Bible in 1383 was about as early as a version could be which was to retain its place among the English people. So let's go to Wycliffe. To the great hall of the Blackfriars Monastery, London, England, on a day in May 1378. Amid purple robes and gowns of satin and damask, amid monks and abbots, and bishops and doctors of the church assembled for the trial of John Wycliffe, the parish priest of Lutterworth. The great hall, crowded to its heavy oaken doors, witnesses to the interest that is centered in the trial, and all eyes are fixed on the pale, stern old man who stands before the dais, silently facing his judges. He is quite alone, and his thoughts go back with some bitterness to his previous trial, when the people crowded the doors, shouting for their favorite. And John of Gaunt and the Lord Marshal of England were standing by his side. He has since learned not to put his trust in princes. The power of his enemies has grown rapidly. Even the young king has been won over to their cause. And patrons and friends have drawn back from the side of him whom the church has now resolved to crush. The judges have taken their seats. The accused stands awaiting the charges to be read. And suddenly there's a quick cry of terror. A strange rumbling sound fills the air, and the walls of the judgment hall are trembling to their base. The monastery and the city of London are being shaken by an earthquake. Friar and prelate grow pale with superstitious awe. Twice already has the arraignment of Wycliffe been strangely interrupted. Are the elements in league with this troubler of the church? Shall they give up the trial? No, thunders Archbishop Courtenay, rising in his place. We will not give up the trial, he says. This earthquake but portends the purging of the kingdom. For as there are in the bowels of the earth noxious vapors which only by a violent earthquake can be purged away, so are there evils brought by such men upon this land which only by a very great earthquake can ever be removed. Let the trial go forward. For translating the scripture into common tongue. Let's pause at this place to try to understand the position of the Church of England at this time and the fact that we have here under censure by that church the man who was giving to England her first complete Bible. It was a critical time in the history of that English church. There were good priests. But also, it was a time when the church in the main was at an age of ignorance and superstition, of worldly ambition and high places of its ranks. Chaucer and other writers of the time give graphic picture of the church's mingled good and evil. The clergy were in the main poorly educated, like television evangelists. The friars, who at their first coming had been such a power for good with their ideals of holiness and voluntary poverty and the popular enthusiasm roused by their preaching, had now, in the course of time, become degraded into idle vagrants and impostors extorting money by the selling of pardons and relics. As if, to quote the words of an old writer, God had given his sheep not to be pastured, but to be shaven and shorn, like the television evangelists. I've tried to point out, in this history of the church, that has survived the centuries, there have always been the pompous Falwells, whatever he is, bakers. The peacockic swaggerts. I got through that real well, didn't I? You try it. You try it. You try it. The peacockic swaggerts. Everybody together now. One, two, three. The peacockic swaggerts. The Roman Sea also was encroaching more and more on the liberties of the Church of England and rousing the ancient spirit of the Baron's Charter at Runnymede. The Church of England must be free. A hostile spirit was growing in the nation, a spirit which might easily turn from hostility toward the papacy to hostility toward religion itself, like now in the television evangelist age. The times were critical, like now. And those who could discern the signs of the times must have seen now that things could not go on much longer as they were. Right. Like now. Her education was rapidly increasing, several new colleges having been founded in Oxford during Wycliffe's lifetime. A strong spirit of independence was rising among the people. Already Edward III and his parliament had indignantly refused the Pope's demand for the annual tribute to be sent to Rome. It was evident that a crisis was near. And as if to hasten the crises, the famous schism of the papacy had placed two popes at the head of the church. I don't know which one was infallible. And all Christendom was scandalized by the sight of the rival vicars of Jesus Christ anathematizing each other from Rome and Avignon, raising armies and slaughtering helpless women and children, each for the aggrandizement of himself. Yeah. Makes the games that Swaggart and Baker play kind of tame and childish. I've been telling you that. No, I'm not going to say what I just thought. Chief amongst the leaders of the patriotic agitation against Roman aggression was John Wycliffe. He was a famous scholar and leader of thought in university circles, as well as amongst the populace. Now, every generation or so, some ignorant man comes along to justify his lazy brain to try to prove that somehow or other education is alien from the Spirit of God. And you got to park your brain to be a Christian. All the time, beating and thumping on a Bible he wouldn't have if it weren't for educated predecessors, and which he could understand if he'd get a little education. I don't suffer fools, and I'm tired of these ignoramuses lifting themselves up as the norm. They're about as normal for Christianity as they are for sex. If you like Jim Baker's brand of religion, you probably like his brand of sex. What would these inerrant Word of God Bible thumpers have done without Wycliffe and Tyndale? Tyndale, a master linguist. Wycliffe, famous scholar and leader of thought in university circles, as well as amongst the populace. He had a powerful following, John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, being one of his staunch supporters. Of course, right now the world would have the church so cripple itself in innocuousness that no man of influence or power would stoop to associate. Preachers must live by Donahue's maximum allowable preacher salary, $25,000 to $50,000 a year, to make sure he can't afford to entertain someone of note in a restaurant. That would use up a whole week of his salary. Preachers should only eat at McDonald's. On special days. Keep them so poor they can't rent a tux, so they can never go to any important function. Every great move of the church, God used men of power, wealth, and influence to help it be affected, and raised up men with the ability to command the respect of such people. The Bethany household was one of the richest in Palestine, where Jesus came lodging often. His uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, one of the richest and most powerful of men, used by God as a protector of the early Christians to settle them in the south of France, where the earliest churches were formed, and Glastonbury, and convert the king's family of Siluria. Paul's brother or half-brothers married to the adopted daughter of Claudius, the real daughter of the Silurian king, that provides the protective circle to guard the Gentile church as it takes shape in the city of Rome, without which influence, Paul never would have been able to appeal to Caesar. The chance of an ordinary Roman citizen getting his appeal heard by Caesar is as remote, if not more remote, than you getting yours heard by the Supreme Court. Wonderful theory. In practice, it doesn't happen. Luther's Reformation would never have gotten off the ground without that powerful German lord that protected him from the armies of the Pope. And Wycliffe's powerful friends, when they departed, his power and influence for the church also waned. Wycliffe supported by the merchant Monmouth. Get off of it. That's what the world and the devil wants, is people who cannot do anything else. Build a little cracker box and praise it be Jesus till they die. But don't let them have any power or influence, wealth or education. Then they'll never bother us. And the whole Christian church is trying to prove its humility by buying that crock of baloney. of theirs. Wycliffe used his great influence not only, which reminds me, that's why we go out and whip the best of them in a horse show. I ain't done with Wycliffe. The world doesn't want anybody to do what the University Network equestrian team does. They don't want to hear that in 4 years, this little work fielded 10% of the United States equestrian team in the World Championships Grand Prix jumping classes in Europe a couple of months ago. The world don't want to hear that. They don't want us in horses. Horses, the sport of kings. It's the domain of the rich and the privileged. You church people go out there and feed the poor that we keep poor, so we don't have to feed them, you know. They're poor because we rob and steal from them and keep them ignorant. And we got all their money. Now, you church people go feed them. We don't like either one of you, the world says. Well, that's a wonderful victory they've accomplished. They get the poor taken care of by the church that they hate. Wycliffe was a famous scholar and leader of thought in university circles, as well as amongst the populace. He had a powerful following, John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, being one of his staunch supporters. And he used his great influence not only against external aggression from the papacy, but also against internal corruptions in the Church of England itself. Who first spoke out against the television evangelists on television? Huh? That's right, years before anybody else. Who called them the airhead fools that they were before anybody else did? Looking back now on certain periods of Wycliffe's career, one is inclined to wonder that the English Reformation of 200 years later did not come in Wycliffe's day. He is called the morning star of the Reformation. His sermons were a great power. His vigorous pamphlets were sent in all directions. But immeasurably above all other influence was the splendid project of giving to his church and nation the first complete Bible in the language of the people. Wycliffe was a most devoted student of Scripture. It was his constant companion, his absolute standard of appeal, and he shows the most intimate acquaintance with his text. In one single volume, he has 700 quotations from Scripture. And it was his contemporaries' recognition of his reverence for it that gained for him the title of the Evangelical Doctor. Naturally, such a man would feel that at such a time, the firmest charter of the church would be the open Bible in her children's hands. The best exposure of the papal policy, the exhibiting to the people the life of Christ. The sacred scriptures, he said, are the property of the people, and one which no one should be allowed to wrest from them. I pray with all my heart that through doing the things contained in this book, we may all together come to the everlasting life. This Bible translation he placed for the first in importance of all his attempts to reform the English church. And he pursued his object with a vigor and against an opposition that reminds one of the old monk of Bethlehem. And his Bible, the Vulgate, 1,000 years before. Wycliffe was a born fighter. and England sorely needed such at the time. He was sometimes an incautious teacher. As he grew older, opposition tended to make him extreme and one-sided. He became almost an anti-clerical. It's harder and harder to love some damn preachers. It's and harder each day. Well, it's harder and harder to love some damn preachers. It's harder and harder each day. If they could, they would change me and then rearrange me. That's harder and harder each day. But I am what I am with my hells and my dams. They can take it and shove it, I pray. Well, it's harder and harder to love some damn preachers. It's harder and harder each day. Well, it's harder and harder to love some damn preachers. It's harder and harder each day. I like that song better all the time. If he had his way, he would have made a clean sweep of much of the ministerial forms and ancient usages of the church. From attacking the faults of certain bishops, he went on to attack the institution of episcopacy itself. He laid little stress on baptism, but he did splendid work in vindicating the position of Holy Communion. Your pastor ain't so strange. Just looks strange to the ignorant who have taken the ignorant error as the norm. He spoke slightingly of the accustomed ritual of the church service. And some of his writings would almost suggest that his ideal of a church would be just a set of wandering preachers of the gospel. One of the charges against Wycliffe was that he had made the Bible common. Understandable. More open to laymen and even to women than it was wont to a clergy well learned and of good understanding, so that the pearl of the gospel is trodden under foot of swine like you. Ordinary people. His indomitable courage was the chief thing needed just then. The result of the trial at Blackfriars was that after 3 days' deliberation, Wycliffe's teaching was condemned, and at a subsequent meeting he himself was excommunicated. But he was allowed to return to his quiet parsonage at Lutterworth, for his opponents did not care to proceed to extremities. And there, with his pile of old Latin manuscripts and commentaries, he labored on at finishing the great work of his life till the whole Bible was translated into the mother tongue, and England received for the first time in her history a complete version of the Scriptures in the language of the people. And scarce was his task well finished when the brave old priest laid down his life. He himself had expected that a violent death would have finished his course. His enemies were many and powerful. The primate, the king, and the pope were against him. With the friars, whom he had so often and so fiercely defied, the scene has frequently been described of the friars pressing round what seemed to be the deathbed of their old assailant, adjuring him to recant and receive their absolution, And the stern old man, raising himself suddenly to startle them with his fierce prophetic cry, shouted, "I shall not die but live to declare again the evil deeds of the friars." But eventually, death arrived. While his friends were anxiously anticipating the worst, the old man was not, for God took him. It was at the close of the old year, the last Sunday of 1384, and his little flock at Lutterworth were kneeling in hushed reverence before the altar, when suddenly, at the time of the elevation of the sacrament, he fell to the ground in a violent fit of the palsy and never spoke again until his death on the last day of the year. In him, England lost one of her best and greatest sons, a patriot sternly resenting all dishonor to his country, a reformer who ventured his life for the purity of the church and the freedom of the Bible, an earnest, faithful parson of the time standing out conspicuously among the clergy of the time. A horrible comment on the intolerant spirit of the time is this extract from one of the monks who wrote of the time describing Wycliffe's death. Quote, "On the feast of the Passion of St. Thomas of Canterbury, John Wycliffe, the organ of the devil, the enemy of the church, the idol of heretics, the image of hypocrites, the restorer of schism, the storehouse of lies, the sink of flattery, being struck by the horrible judgment of God, was seized with the palsy throughout his whole body, and that mouth which was to have spoken huge things against God and his saints and holy church was miserably drawn aside and afforded a frightful spectacle to beholders. His tongue was speechless and his head shook, showing plainly that the curse which God had thundered forth against Cain was also inflicted on him." End quote. I doubt anybody knows the name of that stupid monk. I don't. Wycliffe is deemed the morning star of the Reformation. Sometime after his death, a petition was presented to the Pope, which to his honor he rejected, praying the Pope to order Wycliffe's body to be taken out of consecrated ground and buried in a dunghill. But 40 years after, by a decree of the Council of Constance, the old reformer's bones were dug up and burned and the ashes flung into the little river Swift, which runneth hard by his church at Lutterworth. And so the oft-quoted words of old Fuller, "As the Swift bear them into the Severn, and the Severn into the narrow seas, and they again into the ocean, thus the ashes of Wycliffe is an emblem of his teaching, which is now dispersed over all the world." But it is with his Bible translation that we are especially concerned. You interested?
In Africa, Europe, South America, the Caribbean, Mexico, Canada, or anywhere else in the world, call Collect, area code 818-240-8151. That's area code 818-240-8151. In the United States, it's 1-800-338-3030. That's 1-800-338-3030. But when I've been dead, I won't spend much time on the Dr. Scott teaches every Sunday morning in the Los Angeles University Cathedral at 933 South Broadway between 9th and Olympic in the heart of downtown Los Angeles. The service starts at 11 a.m. and passes are required. Call and make reservations at 1-800-338-3030. That's 1-800-338-3030. Or call collect to 818-240-8151. That's 818-240-8151.
Wycliffe's Bible was a translation from the Latin to English, an accomplishment that brought the Bible into the native language. Another 100 years would go by before Wycliffe would do his translation that really sets the shape of the English language. In distinction from Wycliffe, Erasmus' Greek New Testament had been produced primarily utilizing the third edition of Erasmus' Greek New Testament. Wycliffe translated direct from the Greek, utilizing the Vulgate, utilizing Luther's German translation, but primarily Erasmus' third edition from the Greek and from Old Testament Greek translations. In our Bible Museum has taken shape. We have not only Wycliffe and Tyndale represented, but we have something not even the Huntington Library has, not even the British Museum has. The only fragment in existence, the only copy, not complete, but a large portion, of Wycliffe's translation of the Book of Joshua into the English language, or rather Tyndale's only translation of the Book of Joshua into the English language. The distinction, again I repeat, Wycliffe from Latin, the standard Vulgate into English, Tyndale from the Greek into the English language. And then after Tyndale, the Great Bible, the Geneva, the bishops, and then 1611, the first edition, King James, in five printings successively over the next two decades. But it is Tyndale that shapes the translation direct from the Greek to the English language. Now get on the telephone, do a little work. I've entertained you, I've taught you, now you talk to me.